Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising 5 kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
And we're vaccinated! Yay!
Well, the first dose.
Well, the first dose. That's right. That's our big news of the week. Like so many other people around who are just getting the vaccination, getting eligible. Depending what state you're in, every adult over the age of 16 can get a vaccine in some states. And here it's, you have to have, I think it's opening to everyone in April. We happen to have pre-existing conditions that make us eligible. Are we lucky?
Yay.
I've never been so happy to have pre-existing conditions.
I have to say it was a relatively painless
procedure, so to speak.
Incredibly efficient.
Let's start with the getting the appointment. Getting the appointments in Massachusetts has been notoriously bad. The state website has been overwhelmed. When appointments become available, they're almost impossible to book before they run out. It's like getting tickets to a hot concert and getting on the Ticketmaster website. Like, it has been bad. But the little known secret is that towns are also, the individual towns, the boards of health, are doing their own vaccinations. Yeah, and so I was on our town Facebook group, and the board of health, go to this website, and they're working with 2 other towns, because we're all small towns, so they work together. Go to the site. I'm like, all right, well, I'll go to the site. Boom, had appointments. I'm like, I ran into you, and I said, quick, book an appointment for Thursday at 2 o'clock.
That was on, like, what? Saturday.
I think it was Saturday. Yeah.
So we got less than a week away, and we showed up actually early. We were like 10 minutes early.
We were like 20 minutes. I got there really early.
We were early. We were thinking there might be lines. There was no line. They just went ahead and like had us.
Yeah.
Go
very efficient.
It was drive through.
Yes.
We didn't even have to get out of the car.
I wanted to get a Chick-fil-A at the end of it.
No Chick-fil-A. The people were incredibly nice and very helpful and
friendly.
Very friendly.
Competent.
The one nurse was like cracking jokes. She was hilarious.
Very funny. She was nice. And then the EMTs.
The EMTs were the ones who actually administered the shots, and they were good. Super, super great.
Yeah. You answered that you do have a potential, you've previously had an allergic reaction to a vaccination.
To a drug.
To a drug. That's right. And so we had to go into the 30-minute waiting line where you had to sit and wait for 30 minutes. And it was just you and me.
It did not feel like...
Or was our COVID date?
It did not feel like a very long 30 minutes, I have to say.
And us sitting together in the car chatting. We have a long history of making the time fly by through talking.
And another mark for efficiency, they had a QR code that you scanned with your phone and you signed up for your follow-up second shot.
While you were doing the waiting afterward.
Right. So no time wasted.
No time wasted. Yeah, like the EMT who was watching over the people in the waiting area would walk by with a piece of paper, hold it up, you'd take a picture with your phone, and would go to the website, and you'd schedule your next appointment right there. Yeah, awesome. So our next appointment was, April 8th. It's like, so after Easter week, which seems appropriate somehow that on Easter week we will have the resurrection from the lockdown. We'll still have to wear masks and things like that, but it's like a weight lifted, isn't it?
It is.
After the first shot, they say you're 70% protected. But it just feels like that little thing in the back of your mind for the last 9 months of you could get it. And, you know, even if you don't die from it, a lot of people I know who've gotten it.
9 months? 12 months?
12 months, really. Yeah. I think my clock stopped at 9 months. Now it's like it's a canonical 9 months is how long the lockdown is going on. But, you know, Greg Willits got it. He got it bad. Father Roderick got it. He got it bad. You know, lost sense of smell and taste, and, you know, took weeks and weeks of being extra tired. And I was terrified, frankly, of getting it, because I'm like, I can't afford to be knocked out for weeks and weeks. So it is like a burden off of my mind. You know, it's just really great to get that. So really excited. We got the Pfizer. So I heard the funniest meme. It's like, what is it? It was like the whole champagne thing. It's not champagne unless it comes from the Champagne region of France. It's only sparkling wine. Uh-huh. This was it's not true COVID vaccine unless it comes from the Pfizer region, the COVID region of Pfizer. Otherwise it's sparkling vaccine or something. I figured it was. Anyway, now I ruined it because I didn't look it up before I told the joke. Mm. Yeah. Sometimes they work and sometimes they don't.
Sometimes not at all.
Sometimes not at all. So the other thing, that big thing we did this week, was I put together a new shed in the backyard. As I've mentioned before on the show, our house does not have storage. We have an attic with a crawl space sort of thing going on. So it's not really storage. And there's a giant HVAC heat exchanger up there. There's no room. We don't have a basement. We don't have a garage. We have one wooden shed in the backyard that came with the house that has to hold all of the clothes, the camping gear, the kids' bikes, assorted yard stuff, whatever is in there. And it was not enough. And the kids with the bikes, trying to get the bikes in and out, and the lawnmowers out in the weather and all this other stuff. So I ended up buying, with some of our tax return, a plastic resin, you know, injection molded, build yourself shed, 7x7. So it's been sitting in the driveway for a few weeks, waiting for a day.
The weather has not been great.
The weather hasn't been great. And I hadn't had a Saturday free. I've been recording and going on the scouting camping trip and all that sort of stuff. And so finally, this Saturday was free. The weather was perfect, right?
It was 50s. It was pretty good.
I mean, for doing manual labor outside, I wouldn't have wanted it to be much warmer.
Not too hot. Yeah. Not too cold.
The only snag in everything, well, there's a couple snags. One snag was that the instructions say you need two adults to put it together.
Which you did not have.
I did not have. I had me and three children, 8, 10, and 12. And it took about 8 hours. It felt like, maybe not 8 hours, but it was 6 hours, I think it was. And yeah, and at one point I did have to have you come out and help me because I needed someone taller. Yeah, and they would wander off, their attention would wander. The second big snag was it's meant to be built on a platform or a foundation, and I found out why. Because it doesn't sit square, and so getting the roof on when the corners aren't square is nearly impossible. So the roof isn't on perfect. I'm a little worried about a big windstorm. I have some ideas for how to secure it. There are anchor points through the floor, so I might put some anchor bolts through the floor and then some wire up to the ceiling supports, the metal that hold the ceiling, and hope that holds it. I think that would, and I don't think it would take up too much space. It'll be too, but we'll see how that goes. It's worked out so far with the patio gazebo. That's essentially the same method I'm using for that. So we'll see how that goes. But yeah, new shed. So the shed's going to hold the kids' bikes and some other like lawn stuff. And I get some things that hang so you can hang stuff in it and stuff. But yeah, it worked out. It was, yeah, and you were helpful. Thank you. And at one point I did have to go to the neighbors and ask if I could go stand. It's up against the fence against my neighbors, and I had to go into his yard on the ladder to reach over and pound the roof into place. And I think I woke him up. I think he works nights. So I feel bad. I want to like make him a plate of cookies and bring him over and say thank you.
We could do that. Our new neighbors.
Yeah.
They just moved in a few months ago. Months ago, yeah.
We don't really know them yet because, you know, COVID. So I feel bad. But because I think I woke him up. I was embarrassed. So he was nice about it, though. So that was the other big thing we did this week. And then in meanwhile, the kids have been so excited that they can get their bikes in and out that they've been riding their bikes the last 2 days.
That's been nice.
So that's been good. And now the other shed has a big open space inside. Now, today was Sunday as we record. We went to Mass and then we went to go visit my mom this afternoon. She lives with my brother, as mentioned before. And to give my brother and his wife a bit of a break, each of the siblings, we go over and spend a Sunday afternoon with my mom. And so I went with the kids and we hung out with my mom. And you stayed home.
I stayed home. I was
things done.
I was feeling really, really exhausted yesterday.
Yeah.
Just like totally wiped out. And so I thought I'd rest. And what happened instead is I went on a house cleaning binge and I did so much, so much.
The house looks awesome.
I vacuumed. I cleaned off counters. I wiped down the toilet. I picked up trash in the yard.
You organized
the shoes and tidied up the living room. Yeah. And I made chicken stock to replenish the freezer store for making quick soups. It was a lot.
I mean, we came home and it looked great. You really
and you know,
went all out.
I have felt like just in the worst slump for the last couple of months. And I was really feeling like I am a terrible housekeeper. I am lazy. I just cannot do anything. And like, really all I needed was an afternoon when there was nobody else here. And it was like, oh, I'm not lazy. I need space, like mental space, like physical space, like nobody else here space.
Right.
It was like magic. I was like, oh, yeah, I remember what this is like nobody else being here and being able to get stuff done. It's magic.
It's like introvert pep pills.
Seriously. And I did like Isabella's schedule for the week, like, which is one of those things I usually put off until after, like late Sunday night after we've recorded the podcast. And I was like, oh, and I read like a chapter in my devotional book. It was awesome. I was so productive in like 4 hours. I did like weeks worth of work.
So the solution for the future is for me to take all 5 kids to places.
Yes.
For an afternoon.
All 5 kids.
I'm happy to do that. We'll go hike in the woods. We'll go, you know, play on the beach, you know, in the sand or, you know, whatever. We'll go do stuff. Why not? I think that's a great idea.
Of course, the thing is that like if you're going on a hike in the woods, I like to do that too. So it's hard to like.
We're gonna go on a hike in the woods. You stay home and clean.
See, that doesn't sound so exciting.
We'll go visit my mom once a month. We're gonna spend a Sunday visiting my mom.
Which is, I mean, it sounds like I don't like visiting with your mom, which is not true at all. I love your mom.
Yeah,
and it's just that
as an introvert, you get to a point where you need some space and this is a way to give you some space.
And with homeschooling, like you work from home and the kids are like home all the time. And there's not a lot of like time when there aren't people around.
Well, and for the past year, you usually will get every once in a while an opportunity to go off by yourself, go and drive into town, you know, take the tea into town, go to the museum, hang out in a coffee shop. But of course, the last year you haven't been able to do that. And
that's
so
true.
There's because I was just asking like earlier, like besides doctor's appointments and church and going to the pharmacy, like where have you gone, been able to get out and go to in the past month?
Right. I mean, we've done some park, you know, going to the park and that sort of like hikes and
but it's been a bit stuff. Since we've been able to do that. Like, I mean, it's been more than a month. Since you've been able to do that.
That's true.
So, yeah, I get it. We need to make some time for you to be able to do that sort of thing. I mean, even for me, during the day, I'm in the office, I have the door closed, I'm, you know, alone for hours at a time.
That's true.
You know, so.
I'm never alone.
You're never alone.
Never, ever, ever alone.
The introvert's nightmare. So,
it's been a good week. And spring is here now.
Yes.
Saw the first crocuses today when we came home from Mass,
yep.
Which are our first flowers of the spring. So
temps in the mid-60s.
So exciting.
Sunny skies. It's going to be 60s all week. Yeah, this is the way March is supposed to be. In recent years, March has, it's supposed to, you know, come in like a lion and go out like a lamb. That's what it's doing this year so far. Knock on my wooden head. But in the recent years, it's been like come in like a lion, go out like an angry lion.
That's true.
It's like April comes in and it's still bitterly cold and rainy and snowy. And like 2015 was the benchmark for worst spring ever, because it was like below freezing well into the end of April. Like we couldn't have an Easter egg hunt in Easter that year because there was a foot and a half of snow on the ground still. Like
there was a lot of snow that year.
Well,
though,
that was the record breaking snow year. But yes, I mean, but this year it's yes. This is the way spring should be. As I take a deep sigh, let's move on to talk about food, because this past week was an important food week in the Catholic Church
and in the Bettinelli family.
And in the Bettinelli family. So, yeah, of course, you get the big ones, Christmas and Easter. Those are big food Catholic holidays. But the next tier of important food Catholic holidays are St. Patrick's Day and St. Joseph's Day, which come in the same week. Aren't we lucky? And because St. Joseph's Day is a solemnity, which fell on a Friday this year in Lent, that the solemnity trumps fast, since trumps Lent and trumps fasting. So you have to feast instead of fast. So we could have meat. I hope everyone listening to my voice who wanted to have meat, who wishes they could have had meat on St. Joseph's Day, because I'm sorry if you didn't. So on St. Patrick's Day, we, of course, had corned beef. But I think we talked about this last year. We do our corned beef a little differently.
Yeah, I mean, so we don't always have corned beef. Sometimes we have like a
we've
nice
had Guinness Irish stew. Have we had lamb?
Yeah, probably.
Maybe like a lamb stew or a shepherd's pie.
Yeah.
Which one's the one with lamb?
Shepherd's pie.
Shepherd's pie. Okay.
Shepherd's lambs.
Right. And cottage pie is the beef.
Yes.
Because cows and cottages.
Well, something like that.
Anyway, we had corned beef, but we don't boil it because boiling meat is wrong in many. I'm sure there's instances where boiling meat is okay, but in this case, no. So roasting the corned beef.
Yeah, it's a slow roast method, which I really like. Also, I do not like caraway, so I skip the like usual little seed packet that comes with the corned beef.
Right.
And just pepper.
Just pepper.
It's already salted. You don't need to salt it.
Don't salt the corned beef.
Do not salt
the corn in corned beef means salt. Corn is an old-fashioned word for salting things. I heard on American Catholic History, as they were talking about the history of St. Patrick's Day, one of the things that Tom was saying in that episode was corned beef is an American tradition.
Yes.
It wasn't an Irish tradition. And it comes from the fact that back when the late 19th century, a lot of the Irish were still poor and meat was a celebration dish. Like you didn't get a lot of meat. You didn't get a lot of beef in poorer households. And so when they wanted to celebrate, the Irish housewives would go down to, especially in New York and Boston, in the seaport cities, would go down to the docks, to the ships returning from sea, and they would buy the leftover salted beef off the ships.
That sounds a little apocryphal to me.
It does. I'd like to see some documentation on that.
I mean, the explanations I've heard were more about, like, Jewish delicatessens, but...
Yeah, but that would sell corned beef brisket.
Brisket, yeah. because in Ireland the actual equivalent dish that's popular in Ireland is boiled bacon,
right?
Like the boiled dinner in Ireland is
pig boiled pork.
Pig. Yeah. Yeah, because pigs are the kind of animals that one could actually like raise,
right?
And
right.
have for feasts, but you know the adaptation in America, like to you know having Jewish delicatessens, is you get.
Well, Jewish dietary laws say no pork.
No pork.
So beef would be the thing.
Right. I don't know. Maybe there's some truth to both of them, but anyway. Right.
I wouldn't be surprised if the buying the leftover salt beef happened.
Occasionally. I can't imagine there was a whole lot of extra beef after.
I think it would depend on the voyage. But perhaps. I would guess that a lot of the like sea ship owners would not want to buy extra in waste. Right. That's sort of, so you're probably right there.
Anyway,
so corned beef. We had cabbage.
Yeah, I like to do my cabbage like sauteed with onions and let it get nice and caramelized. And then Isabella's favorite thing is cabbage with a balsamic reduction.
Not very Irish.
No. Well, you know.
We make accommodations.
And
but neither is corned beef, as we just said.
It's pretty good. It's not my favorite way to eat cabbage, but it's tasty and it always makes her happy. And then we had some mashed potatoes to go along with it. Also, yeah, St. Patrick's Day is Lucia's baptism day.
That's right.
Which was a little bit of canny planning on my part.
Yes, but way back when.
Way back when. And so we had some leftover chocolate cake in the freezer from Sophia's birthday. And we had chocolate cake for nice. Dessert.
Very, very good planning back on Sophie's birthday to put that cake, the rest of that cake in the freezer.
Yeah, I was pretty pleased.
Well, also good thing that we had the new freezer that we had room to put it in.
Right, the old freezer
would never would have happened. Yeah, so awesome.
So yeah, then for St. Joseph's Day,
my plan was I came up with the plan. I said if I can find a flank steak at the grocery store, I was going to make brujol. Now, brujol is a rolled, stuffed beef dish, Italian roast beef.
Okay, but it's not spelled like where you would think that it sounds like brujol. Brujol is like the Sicilian.
Brujol is the Sicilian American way of saying it. It's bracciola.
Bracciola.
Bracciola. Bracciola or E.
Bracciola.
It's the A or E, depending on where you are in Italy. Okay. But yeah, but Sicilians, we say brujol.
Right.
It's almost sounds Russian, actually. I was thinking.
Well, I was reading a article not too long ago about like Sicilian Italian, and it's a completely it's really a different language.
When Sicilians they talk about the bathroom, it's called the bagahaus, which literally is an Italianization of the English word backhouse or outhouse. Yeah, my dad my grandparents, especially my grandmother, only spoke the Sicilian dialect. So, but my dad spoke it, and all when we would go over my aunt's house to visit with my grandparents, my grandmother, they would all be speaking this stuff. So this is the words I heard, especially around food. Right. I learned the food words.
It's kind of funny because like I spent time in Italy, but I spent time in
Rome.
In Rome,
they speak proper Italian. Well,
it's definitely a different dialect.
Oh yeah.
And so I'm not super fluent in it, but I know some Italian, and I especially know a lot of culinary Italian, but when you talk, like, your culinary words are all Sicilian dialect, so sometimes I have to, like, stop and think, what is he talking about?
So Sicilian is to, like, Roman Italian as Cajun, deep Cajun would be to, like,
to French?
Connecticut English.
Oh, okay.
Like, a Cajun, I guarantee I get down on the Cajun Caballo. And then, you know, the Connecticut English, you know, the upper crusty Connecticut English would be the, like, Roman Italian. Very proper, spoken right. When my dad, we took my dad to Rome 20-odd years ago, and he would try out some of his Sicilian, you know, trying to communicate with people. And they'd kind of look at him like he was kind of slow or something. Like, and they were like, no, he's American. We're American. Oh, Americano. Oh, that's all right. And then they would, you know, but yeah. So anyway, back to the topic at hand, the brujol.
Oh, right. I'm sorry.
So the recipe I used, I made one mistake perhaps among others, but when I was looking at the recipe, I doubled it to see how much it would make if I doubled it. And then I realized, no, the single size is plenty, so I'm just going to get the one flank steak. But I forgot to switch the recipe back in the recipe app to single instead of double. And so when I made all the ingredients for it, apart from the meat itself, I doubled everything.
I did not think that the quantities that you of sauce that you were putting in the pot seems like
way too much sauce, Melody. This is really full. Four cans.
I was like, you do not need four cans. That is way too much.
I used three cans and it was still overflowing. I didn't even use the fourth can.
Three cans was too much.
And then like all of the cheese and all of the golden raisins. So it It has you make a mixture of golden raisins, Parmesan cheese, and parsley and basil and oregano. And then you pack that into the meat and you roll up the meat
and
like
garlic,
a jelly roll.
And garlic too?
Actually what you do is you thin slice up a whole bunch of garlic, twice as much as I needed, and you heat it up in the microwave in some olive oil. And then you strain out the garlic and you reserve that. The garlic will go in. Well, actually, no, half the garlic is supposed to be in that mixture. That's another thing I forgot to. But you also brush the meat with the garlic oil.
The amount of garlic was fine, actually.
Yeah, actually, yes. You never have too much garlic in those things. So then you roll up the meat with the stuffing in it. It's like a jelly roll. And then you tie it off. Then you sear it in the pan on all sides in a skillet. Then you put it in a baking dish, and then you put the sauce ingredients, the tomato sauce. Oh, no. So back up a step. So you put the meat in the baking pan, and then you, in the skillet, the same skillet you seared it in, you cook onions and the garlic and the tomato paste and tomato sauce and some of the other ingredients, you know, the spices and stuff and some basil.
You
make it a tomato sauce, but with the drippings from the meat, which is really good. And then you put that in the pan, then you tightly cover the pan in foil, put it in the oven on a low temp.
So basically you're braising this roll of meat in the tomato sauce.
Yes. And then you cook it in there for an hour and a half to 2 hours. Now, given that there was too much sauce, it didn't cook fast. It didn't cook fast enough. It took way longer, and it wasn't even as done as much as I wanted it to have been done. By the time I took it out, because we had to eat dinner before the kids went to bed. So that was painful.
It was really tasty, though. Yeah. I would totally go for you making it again.
Yes.
With the proper proportions.
The proper proportions. Of time ahead of time to making it.
Yeah, you should have started earlier, like at lunch.
I was gonna, and then we decided that was too early, but it wasn't.
I think I was using the oven for something else.
You were making the potatoes? Well, no, you were making the Zeppoli.
Oh, right. The cream puffs. Yeah. Okay. So that was part of the logistical problem. Those need to dry in the oven.
Right.
To keep them from being too wet.
Right.
But I really liked the golden raisin and parsley mix in the middle.
A very Sicilian thing is to add like raisins or currants or other kinds of fruit into their sauces and meats. And I don't usually like raisins in cooked in things, but this was really good. It really worked.
I really like raisins. Like my moussaka has currants in the tomato sauce with the lamb. It's like tomato sauce with lamb, ground lamb and currants in it. I really like that sweet.
I wonder if it's the sweet and acidity. If it's raisins and tomatoes.
It's a great combination.
I think it is. I mean, it sounds bizarre. Raisins and tomatoes. What do you want? What are you high? No. It actually works really well in these recipes. So it's the America's Test Kitchen. No. It's the cook. Well, it's America's Test Kitchen's Cook's Country Brujol. They have a Cook's Illustrated Brujol that was even more complicated. This one is actually fairly straightforward. Cook's Country, Cook's Illustrated, same company, two different magazines. Cook's Country tends to be a little simpler recipes, a little more down home style.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of like that a little better. The Cook's Illustrated tends more toward the gourmet style. I think that's how they split it. And I kind of like the Cook's Country recipes a little more sometimes. They tend to be a little simpler, a little more straightforward, fewer exotic ingredients, take a little less time, that sort of thing. But so if you're looking for it, it's the Cook's Country Brujol. But as we said, you also made Zeppoli, which is a traditional Italian pastry for St. Joseph's Day.
Or as I call them,
cream puffs.
Cream puffs.
Okay.
Basically, I make the ones that you can deep fry them or you can bake them. I just bake them. And so it's a French
pâte à choux
dough, which this blew Anthony's mind. You put water in a pan on the stove and butter in it, and you melt the butter in the water, and then you bring it to a boil, and then you dump all your flour into
the water.
The water, and you stir until it all comes together into a paste, and then you take it out of the pan. You add you let it cool down a bit because you don't want to cook your eggs. Then you add your egg yolks one at a time
to the batter.
No, whole eggs. whole eggs.
Yeah, to the batter.
To it, and you mix it up, and then you put it back in the pan, and you cook it a little bit more, and then until it's nice and smooth.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pipe it onto the tray.
Right. You just use a piping. Yeah, you piping bag or a spoon.
I just spoon.
You spoon it into just blobs, mounds.
Right. And then what I like to do is I get my finger wet and kind of smooth the blobs out a little bit.
Give them a little shape.
Yeah. And then you cook them slow and low. And then like.
Because the idea is you want them to puff so that this big gaping holes inside.
Right. What you want. Yeah. What you want is like a hollowed out structure.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't want a lot of dough. You want a hollow structure that where all the yummy filling is going to go.
And there's no sugar in the actual cream puff itself. It's just flour, butter, water, and salt.
Yeah.
An egg.
Yeah.
And so then you once they're done cooking, you poke little holes in them just to let the steam out. And then you leave them in the oven with the door cracked while the oven cools down. They dry out.
Right.
So that they're not wet inside.
So I'm guessing the science here is, and I think I remember this from a Good Eats episode, is that all of that water is the steam inside that right. forms the big gaping cavern inside. But the dough, the flour and the water, I think it must gelatinize the exterior
right.
to create the crust. So it gives it the outer structure that holds it when the steam makes the puff in the middle.
Right. And so then I made a pastry cream to go inside,
mm-hmm.
which is basically just milk. It's like a milk and egg custard.
With sugar.
I forgot the sugar and added it to the custard at the last stage. The difference with pastry cream is that it's thickened with like flour and cornstarch.
Uh-huh.
So it's not just a custard. It's like.
Right.
It's like
smoother.
A fortified custard.
Yeah.
This time I made it a little bit differently in that I added some lemon zest into the milk when I was cooking.
Yep.
Which did not make it taste lemony, but it gave it a citrus note.
It's a tiny zing.
Yeah, I really liked that. My cream puffs this time came out the best. Like the pastry was the best and the filling was the best. In the past, I have messed up my pastry cream. And we've had very watery, like, soup.
that was an interesting one. The cream puffs you eat with a spoon.
And I've not cooked the cream puffs or dried them long enough, and they've been, like, damp inside.
That's the key, is you poke the hole, you leave them in the oven with the oven cracked a bit to let steam out, and you let them dry. You let them dry in the oven that's off. That was the key. Still warm, but dry. And then we had some of the puffs left over. So tonight I had the idea. We had ice cream in the freezer that we had from when Sophie was having her braces done, and we thought she might want some ice cream. She never ate it. So we had some vanilla ice cream. I said, what if we put vanilla ice cream in the cream puffs?
It was good, but the cream puffs had already gotten a little stale.
Yeah, but it was almost like a French ice cream sandwich.
Yeah.
If the cream puffs were fresh, it could have been really good. That could have been really good. I mean,
I still like pastry cream better.
Well, okay, yeah, no, I agree. The pastries, the Zeppoli, were really good. And one thing I don't like from the way most Italian ones is they put a maraschino cherry on top. It doesn't need it. It really didn't need it. So anyway,
that makes it look pretty.
It's about the pretty. Yes. All right. The last thing I want to talk about food is
more food
spices.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So we get our spices from the Spice House, thespicehouse.com. That is not a paid endorsement. That's a really great place to get it from. We used to get it from Penzies, but they made politics a big issue, and it was really obnoxious. And I said, I don't want to do business with obnoxious people who don't like me. So I'm going with the Spice House, which it turns out they're from the same family, and they had a split years ago into two different businesses. And so it makes going to the Spice House even a little more delicious, frankly. But they have great spices. They have all the spices that you'd want. And they have this thing where they sell flat packs. Now, part of the problem with mail order spices is it's expensive and it can be very expensive. Like the quality is top notch. They're fresh. They're great. But they can be expensive to buy unless you buy in bulk. And you get, and also you probably want to buy enough where you don't have to pay the shipping because shipping can be expensive. And so we tended to buy large quantities of spices that we would not use for, like it would take us years to use them, even as much as we cook. But they started this new thing a few years ago called flat pack spices, where they are thin paper packages that are generally smaller than their normal sizes. And the whole idea is they can put them all in an envelope and mail them through the U.S. mail for a lot cheaper than they would normally have to ship them in a box. And that, so with that, if you buy flat pack spices from them, they ship for free. So they pay the shipping on the U.S. Postal Service. So I've found myself buying smaller quantities of, basil, oregano, thyme, whatnot. I mean, I still buy several packages at a time, which also means that they're sealed, which is nice, individually sealed. But it means I buy it more often. So instead of buying a big chunk of, a big bag and having to take 3 years to get through it or longer, some of those bags are pretty old in our spice storage. We go through it in 6 months or so, and then we buy more. And so it's fresher. It's always fresher. So just as a sort of a recommendation to check it out, if you find yourself like supermarket spices, I'm sorry, but they're generally not great. You never know how old they are. You never know the quality, but the spice house, the quality is always top notch. So I would check them out. And for any of your spices, if you want vanilla, they have great vanilla. They're vanilla. They get Madagascar and Mexican vanilla. I mean, it's so good.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just wanted to mention, I was thinking about that this week. So that's food. Let's talk about reading and watching. Now, okay. I have actually apparently watched a lot of stuff this week, but I did finish a book, and it was one of the newer Star Wars books called The Light of the Jedi. So this bears just a tiny bit of explanation. They have started a new series of Star Wars stories, Disney has, called the High Republic series. And they've got books and, young adult books and comic books, graphic novels, all this stuff, and regular books, all set in this era. And it takes place about 150 years before the events of the Star Wars movies. And it highlights when the Jedi and the Republic were at their peak. The Jedi were the strongest they ever were, the biggest they ever were. They were still vital and working together and strong in the Force, not the degraded Jedi we saw, say, in the prequels.
So the Jedi in the prequels are not at their best.
Right. They were, they were kind of losing their mojo. They were, they got duped by the Sith.
I mean, I suppose you would have to say that they weren't at their best, because otherwise, like, how did Palpatine convince them to
him? Right. He maneuvered them. They got duped. They got duped into fighting the Separatist War. And all that stuff. So, but in the Light of the Jedi, the Order is huge. There are thousands of Jedi, and they're just reaching the Republic is just reaching out into the Outer Rim. That's where a lot of the events of the movies, like the Star Wars movies, take place. It's very interesting, and they're having to go up against this enemy, this group of, at first they seem like a gang, like a space pirates called the Nihil, the Latin word for nothing.
Uh-huh.
They're nihilists, essentially. What is that phrase from the Big Lebowski? There's a line from Big Lebowski about nihilists. Anyway, so the book was interesting. It was really interesting to see the Jedi in a different light, and the Jedi at their peak, at their best. All kinds of Jedi. There was a Wookiee Jedi.
A Wookiee Jedi.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was kind of cool What are the limitations that Wookiees don't speak well English, or basic, which is their English. And so what are the limitations that a Wookiee has to go through? And yeah, it was really fascinating. There was lots of it that I really liked. Some parts, I don't know. There was, Some parts were a little harder to get through. The first part of the story takes up like a very short part of the whole plot takes up a very large part of the book. There's this whole disaster. I won't say natural or not, but the disaster that takes place and takes up the first third of the whole book. And it might have been a little long, longer than it needed to be. But so I'm interested in reading more books in the series, but this was the first one, Star Wars Light of the Jedi. Several have already come out since I picked this up, but so I'm not sure exactly how many are out now. And I don't know that I'll read all of them. Some are young adult books. One of the things that I wanted to look at with this book is whether the kids could read it. But there are a couple of things that come up in the book. I think we mentioned it last week. This is what we were talking about, like evaluating books for your kids, that I just felt like I didn't want the kids to read. This one, but hopefully some of the young adult ones will be less controversial. So what else did I watch? Couple short. I watched on Disney Plus, there's a National Geographic section. I watched the National Parks. They have a series called National Parks, and this one was on Great Smoky Mountains.
Oh, fun.
And it was really cool. I really enjoyed it was sort of a year, kind of follows a year and follows like primarily a mother bear and her cubs, but also other things in the park and other animals and plants and the life cycle of the park and a little bit of the park's origins and place, you know, the people that made the park what it is. It was cool. It was good. There's some areas of the park that if we ever go back, I would actually let you go see, you know, because we didn't get to see much of the park, but also aspects of the park that are just, you really have to hike into the park to get to it. It's a big park. I didn't realize how big it is, but there is a real backcountry there that you can't drive to. It's in some ways unlike a lot of, well, I was gonna say like Acadia, but Acadia has a big part of the park that you can't drive into that we never saw that I would love to get to someday. So there was that. I watched the making of WandaVision, like Avengers Assembled, the making of WandaVision. Which was fascinating. And one of the things it did was talked about the when they were making. So the premise of the show was that it was a series of sitcoms set in different eras, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. It was part of the premise. You have to watch it to understand why. But when they were doing like the 50s era, they really got into doing it as the 50s. So they had a filmed it for a live studio audience. And they had. Even the crew was dressed in 50s clothing, like people that were never on camera, to kind of get into the feel. And even the special effects, like there were like effects where things had to float like magic. And they like said to the visual effects guys, OK, we want to do this with the same technology and techniques that they had in the 50s. And the guys were like, oh, that's awesome. I learned from those guys. Yes. And so they had the wires and all that stuff.
That's kind of cool.
It was really neat. So there was, it was very interesting to watch. If you've watched WandaVision, which if you would have watched the Marvel movies, you should watch WandaVision. If you've watched WandaVision, you should definitely watch this making of. It was really good. And then I watched Falcon and the Winter Soldier, which is the next new Marvel series on Disney Plus. I've only watched one episode. Pretty good so far. Not much to say yet. It opens with a bang, big action sequence, which I think is de rigueur. And I started watching a movie that is, I saw it had come out, and I don't know whether it was out in the theaters or whatever, but Robert the Bruce with an all-star Scottish cast. Like, every big Scottish actor is in this.
Okay.
Including the guy who plays Robert the Bruce was the same actor who was Robert the Bruce in Braveheart. So it's like, and this is that Robert the Bruce at the end of his reign.
Uh-huh.
So it's almost like a sequel to Braveheart.
Okay.
I've only watched half of it so far, and it focuses actually not as much on Robert the Bruce so far. I mean, it is focused on him, but on a Scottish family that he's about to interact with somehow, I think. I'm not quite sure. I've only watched half of it, but it's kind of good so far. It's very Scottish. I have a thing for Scots, as you might be aware of. I have a thing for the Scot that's sitting next to me, but also for the Scottish people. And I was really enjoying this. The Scottish actors, there's so many great Scottish actors. So that's
fun.
Yeah, that's my list of things. How about you?
Haven't been doing a lot of watching. I actually watched less than half of Captain Marvel last night, and nice. Then I needed to go to bed. I'm still way behind trying to play catch up on Marvel movies, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And that was the next one. Like, if I had started chronologically, which I didn't, because Disney Plus didn't used to have them in chronological order, and now they do.
This might not be...
It says it's second chronologically after...
It's second chronologically in real world terms. So it takes place in the 90s?
Right, in real world terms.
Okay.
So that's how I'm chronologically watching.
Okay, you're watching in real world terms as opposed to in how Marvel made the movies.
No, not in release order, but in internal chronology order.
Okay. That might work.
There's so many of them. You have to have Why some not? Sort of schema yeah. for what, how to watch them.
Why not?
So
I'm all in on that with you.
Right. Then this week I finished what's probably going to be one of my favorite novels of the year, which is Piranesi by Susanna Clarke. And Susanna Clarke, her debut novel was Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which I have read a little bit of, but I haven't, but I watched the miniseries. And Piranesi is very different. It's a very short novel, whereas Jonathan Strange was like a tome. It's very odd. It's almost impossible to talk about without getting too spoilery, but my friend Leah Labresco Sargent said it was one of the most peaceful and restful books that she's read.
But it's a novel.
It is very, there's something about it that's very serene and tranquil, that it's a first person narrative, and the first person narrator, who is unnamed through most of the novel, is living in this very strange place where it's like a house, but the house is like the entire world, and it's three levels. The bottom level is like ocean. It has tides. Sometimes the at high tides, the water comes up into the second level and beyond. And then the third level is like has places where it's sort of filled open with clouds, and it's open to the sky. And it's old. There's parts of it that are ruined, and it's filled with statues. And so it's got all these like staircases and galleries and statues. And he seems to be. He and there's one other person who character in the first part of the book seem to be, as far as he knows, the only living people in existence in this world. And there's like birds and him and this one other guy who shows up occasionally. But he turns out to be a very unreliable narrator. But he's a very cheerful, happy, likable narrator. And he just like. It's very charming to spend a lot of time with him. The other guy, who he just calls the other, calls him Piranesi. And the name Piranesi actually is the name of an Italian artist who is most famous for drawing these pictures of prisons, like fantastical imaginary prisons that are sort of based on Roman ruins. He was an Italian artist. And there's these sort of beautiful, sort of dreamy landscapes and interiors that he drew. And I feel like the novel is definitely drawing on, it's a very architectural novel. It's very concerned with
place.
Space.
Yeah.
Rooms and galleries that are sort of an entire
world. Yeah.
And so there's some really interesting, stuff going on. There's a lot of sort of symbolism. The story gets kind of dark at times, but never depressing. Like, it still manages to, even when it's kind of the tension is building, it still manages to be very tranquil. It was a great novel to read. And I went through and I read some reviews. And because it came out recently, a lot of people were reading it last year, like during their pandemic lockdown, and it seemed to have been
about a guy stuck in a house.
Right. It seems to have been a very popular novel, but people really liked it because it kind of speaks to this like feeling of entrapment and yet freedom. Like, he doesn't feel trapped. He feels at home in the world, and there's this almost spiritual quality, this spiritual relationship he has with the house. He sees the house as being sort of a benevolent
almost
presence.
Like God, almost.
Right. Like the house provides all that I need, he says. The house is beautiful. The house is perfect. Even though it's kind of falling down in ruins, through his eyes, there's a perfection there. Like he doesn't see any flaws in it.
You know, based on your descriptions, and now I've been looking at Piranesi, the artist's paintings, I'm wondering how much of these paintings inspired Clark's vision of the house.
I mean, I really feel like looking at his paintings, there's definitely a lot of that architectural sense. And yet I didn't look at his pictures while I was reading, and my internal sense of it was different.
Mm.
It felt bright, like his etchings kind of are dark, whereas I felt like the house was very bright and airy and spacious.
Mm.
Some of his drawings kind of feel a little bit, I wouldn't say claustrophobic, but kind of enclosed. And I didn't feel like that was the sense that you get from the novel.
Right.
Anyway, I highly recommend Piranesi. Just a very pleasant novel to read. There's a mystery at the heart of it. And, you know, who is this guy? Where is he? Why is he there?
What is this place?
What's going on? How did he get there? And the unraveling of the mystery was really enjoyable.
Hmm.
Even if you don't like mystery novels, I would think that it would still be
interesting. I have a theory, but I won't spoil it by talking about it here.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. That was our segment in which we talk about things we've watched and read. Let's talk a little bit very quickly about this Sunday's gospel. This is the last Sunday before Holy Week. Next week is Palm Sunday, as we discussed this. And so this week we heard readings about, well, the grain of wheat that needs to fall and die. And I thought it was interesting as I was thinking about this, how it's paired with what Christ talking about, the crucifixion and how he'll be raised up. And it's interesting that he is, of course, the grain of wheat that has to fall and die and then be raised up. But two different reflections that you read that you thought were really interesting on this gospel.
Right. I read a reflection from Mother Sophia of Mount St. Mary's Abbey, and also from Father Philip, who's a Dominican in, I think he's in New Orleans. He was former chaplain of the University of Dallas, which is how I came into contact with him. And they both talked about death. This Father Philip sort of said, this is Death Sunday, which is sort of appropriate as the Sunday before Palm Sunday. He said that he felt like maybe the liturgical color should be black instead of purple, because it really does focus on this idea of the grain of wheat falling. And Jesus talks about being troubled, which is something that Mother Sophia pulls out. And she talks about, in her reflection, the memento mori. You know, as a Benedictine, one of the things that's prominent in the rule of Saint Benedict is that the monastics of Benedict's order live with the thought of death always before them. But she talks about how it's not, and she talks about several different martyrs and martyrdom, but then she talks about sort of, it's not a grim, like, bleak self martyrdom, like not about like crucifying oneself.
It's not very goth or emo.
No, but it's about awareness of the beauty and the fragility of life, that life is...
The fragility of life is what makes it beautiful and amazing.
Right. And that there's something very fragile and precious about it, and that we don't hold on to, but that we sort of allow to unfold.
Hmm.
She talks about, she reads from this reflection from Olivier Clement. She says, we may think of the abbot who keeps a skull on his desk, or the monk who digs a spade of dirt out of his grave every day, but that's not really the mindfulness of death in the monastic tradition. It's not an intellectual exercise or an act of the imagination. It's an existential event, a feeling of the finiteness, alienation, horror, and precariousness before the fragility of life in my own person and the lives of all people who we seek to carry in our hearts. The daily look at death in the eye means to allow ourselves to be moved by the fragility of life. The fear and anguish we experience draw us into Jesus's moment of reckoning. Memento mori moves seamlessly into memoria dei, memory of God. So the mindfulness of death should be linked with the name of Jesus, the name of death's conqueror. Thus I know at once what I am saved from and by whom.
Mm.
So it's that the mindfulness of death brings us to Christ and conquering of death. And so it's not sort of this grim, bleak.
Yeah, dwelling on, oh, my own death, how depressing.
But it's really about how death leads us into the mystery of the crucifixion and resurrection and redemption, that it brings us to Christ itself.
Right.
It is our death that ultimately will bring us to
mindfulness of death is really mindfulness of what of Christ conquering death. It's really mindfulness of the resurrection, because death is not the end of the story anymore because of Christ.
Right.
I like that. It's very good. Yeah, she mentions earlier in her reflection, I saw something just that leaped out at me, where she the Benedict's actual words from the rule, look death daily in the eye. And I'm thinking, that's metal, man. That's real. Like,
right?
That's like a Klingon warriors phrase. Klingon warriors would be great Benedictines, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there is something really profoundly countercultural about Catholic religious, and
especially the Benedictine Trappist thread of them.
Right. There's a great poem by the Irish poet Paul Durkin about the Irish nuns dying in a convent inferno in Dublin. And there's this section where the speaker, who's this Irish nun who is going to die in this blazing inferno, looks at the goth punk kids hanging out at the street corner as she walks by. And she talks about how they wear this countercultural uniform. And she says, but we're really the real radical countercultural people, like right. she and her sisters. And there's this kind of moment of affinity and sort of affection for the punk kids. But there's also a sense of, like, we go even further than they do into really embracing the radicalness of Christ's, not just his death, but his conquering of death, not just martyrdom, but this, like, Christ, Christ, come quickly. She quotes from Gerard Manley Hopkins' Wreck of the Deutschland. So there's something beautiful and radical about Catholic religious.
Yes, they're the best. So, all right, I think that should do it for our discussion this week. We want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Emily W., Joe K., Guy N., Paula K., and Keith M. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give. Make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. Now is a great time to become a StarQuest patron, thanks to a generous gift from a StarQuest supporter. When you start a new Patreon monthly pledge at sqpn.com/give, the first 3 months will be matched by an equal amount from our donor, which supports all our shows, including this one, and makes your gift go even further. And we're more than halfway, more than two-thirds at this point, of our goal to our goal of $2,000 in new monthly pledges, which is important. That goal is going to help us do some new things. We have some new shows that we're developing. We need to revamp our website and so stuff like that. So if you could become a supporter and help us close the gap, and remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, so we are a tax deductible organization, consultant tax professional. And if you've been thinking of becoming a StarQuest patron, now's the time. Visit sqpn.com/give today. So that's it from us. If you have any thoughts, any comments, any feedback on our discussion, you can let us know by commenting at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. Relevant links for our discussion are in our show notes on sqpn.com. Remember to like Raising the Bets on the StarQuest Facebook page, retweet us on Twitter, where we're at SQPN, and leave us comments wherever you see us. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.